As we speak.
Yeah, we're recording. Mm-hmm. All right. All right, you ready?
Yes, sir.
All right, three.
Oh. You always go up one, two, three.
Oh, my God. I can't even get this right.
From late June to early August, we took a 14,000-mile cross-country road trip to get away from the world.
It brought us to 20 national parks, 33 states, 46 cities, and 43 national monuments, forests, memorials, grasslands, and recreation areas.
So in each episode, we'll outline one of our stops, talk about the history of the place, our impressions, and a piece of dark history tea associated with it.
It's gonna be dramatic, scandalous, dare I say captivatingly funny, and hopefully it inspires your next trip in the United States.
This is Road Boys with Jeremy
and Jacob. Welcome to another episode of Road Boys. Boys on the road.
We don't even have to do that anymore, Jacob. They know.
The road persons do know exactly what's going on here now. It's actually wonderful.
I'm glad it stuck around. The road persons do exactly know when they see an episode pop up that it's going to be us recording another episode of our podcast, which we don't even have to say the name of anymore.
Yes, and our latest listener, who I'm very excited about, is none other than Mr. Aaron Rodgers.
Mr. Aaron Rodgers has entered the chat. Hello.
Mr. Aaron Rodgers, thank you so much for listening to Road Boys.
Mr. MVP.
We appreciate the love.
How do we know it's Aaron Rodgers? Well, I think we have a listener in the area in which he grew up in, and it's him.
It's Aaron Rodgers. So thank you so much for listening. I wanted to start the show off today by talking about how great I look.
Oh, okay. You know, a little bit standoffish, Jacob. We'll start off with that. What's new?
No, it's just the job that I have that I'm legally not allowed to talk about that I'm going to talk about. I've been doing very physical stuff. That's the most I'll say about it, and it has done wonders for my physique.
Ooh, tell me about that now.
I just told you about it. It's done wonders.
Are you gonna go in depth with these wonders?
I don't know. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm gonna
look. Tell me exactly how the science works there.
Well, you see, what happens is when you work out, it kind of tears your muscles a little bit, and then they grow back a little stronger. That's what working out is.
Now, tell me more about this job that you can't tell me about. What's getting your body into shape like this?
Oh, well, I can't tell you about that.
He's sitting at a desk typing.
Yeah,
It's his fingers that are looking amazing right now.
Yeah, like, fuck the rest of my body, but my fingers are going to look amazing.
He's a hand model. Best type of model.
The Seinfeld did an episode on that where George Costanza became a hand model and he was constantly freaking out about his hands and like getting them, you know, ruined.
Well, I'm pretty self-conscious about my hands. I don't think it could ever be a hand model now.
Are you self-conscious about your hands?
Yeah, I'm just like Uncle Jack in It's Always Sunny. My hands, nobody look. Nobody look.
Jeremy, this whole time I'm going to just be staring directly at your hands and I want you to know that.
Well, good thing we're on a Zoom call, so I can just put them to the side so you can't see them. But
I can always see them.
We can always envision them. I know.
Well, anyway, what were you up to this week?
Well, I was kind of incommunicado this week.
I know.
Incommunicado. I don't know how much I could talk to you about what I did, but I'll go more in depth than you did. I'll just say what I did this week, and it was involving this election. Remember last week we did a Get Out the Vote special. Well, after what I talk about right now, I think we can just name this one the Get Out the Vote special too, because these past 4 days I've been working as an election judge in my local polling station for early voting. It was quite the experience, Jacob, let me tell you.
And how's that been?
It went well. I think, you know, if you're watching the news or you're looking at Twitter, you know that turnout for the election is high, which is good news for democracy. It means that people are going out to vote, whoever they're voting for. They're being able to go out there during a pandemic and just safely get out the vote, even in person. And that's where I was. I was stationed right by my house. But the thing was that every single day for the past 4 days, I've had to wake up at like 5 o'clock, stay there until 9:30. So those are like 15-hour days, but I have to say, all in all, very rewarding work, and getting out the vote, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw your paycheck, and it definitely looks like very rewarding work.
Well, let me tell you about that hazard pay now. Thank you to my county executive and that nice little hazard pay bonus. But
you know, I will say one more thing about my job that I'm not supposed to talk about is that I face damn well 15 million more hazards than you do at what I do, and I don't get no hazard pay.
Well, those are things that are physical things. Those things could crush you. Those things could seriously injure you. This is protecting me from people, which is more
dangerous. Well, there you go.
Which is, I'll let the listener decide who's more dangerous right now, people or objects that could fall and kill you in an instant.
That would be a good fan question if someone would send it to us at Road Boys Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just got to throw that in there. Which is more dangerous, people or the machines?
People or the machines. Well, I think maybe by the end of this episode, maybe we'll have someone who sent it in. Who knows?
We'll have to see.
We could save it for another week. If you send it in, we'll get to it.
Yeah, please be hitting us up. You can DM us. You can send us messages. We want to hear from you, get your feedback, and definitely get some more fan questions to keep this thing going.
Exactly.
But one last thing I actually want to say before we really get into this huge show today.
Huge.
Is that when you are voting at this point, we're releasing on Sunday, which is 2 days before Election Day, you should not be mailing in your damn ballot.
No, if you haven't done that already, if you have your ballot and it's at home, well, thank you. You've only done 50% of what you need to do. So you voted, and you stupid idiot, you haven't returned it yet.
It's foolish.
It's foolish. It's damn foolish. But guess what? You can redeem yourself. There's a redemption arc to this story.
gotta have the full character arc.
A full character arc, because by the time you realize that, oh no, I can't mail in my ballot, you will have realized there is a savior in the fact that you can submit it in person at a bunch of different locations. We have a voting boxes, places for your ballot drop boxes. That
wow.
is the correct term.
Struggle
that is
bus.
The correct term. And you can just go right up to them. And at the end of the day, I think they're cleared every so often during the day, and they get taken to the election boards, your respective election boards. And then you'll know your vote will be counted because it'll be there. It won't be in a bin in your post office on November 4th.
Well, there you go. You don't want it in a bin on November 4th. And also, I wonder, has anyone ever seen them clearing the election boxes?
I know that it's sort of like a tree falling in the forest type of deal. If it happens, does anyone see it? Does anyone hear it?
Apparently not, because I have not seen a single photo, video. I have not seen it in person of anybody clearing out those boxes.
Oh, yes, the man in the nice little white sedan, no markings, no late note, no plates, comes up, he just, you know, rips off the door and takes them. That's how it's supposed to be done in most precincts.
Hey, that's democracy, folks.
That's democracy.
That's enough of that. Let's get into our huge show today, because there is simply no time to waste, Jeremy.
We have been wasting too much time indeed. So, yes, I am excited. Let's get into it, sir.
Yes. So last week, if you remember, we were at the Great Sand Dunes.
You got to stop rolling your R's, because I can't come back at you with anything.
It's all right. It's my superior talent. But the Great Sand Dunes were so fantastic.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, otherworldly. And let me, we can't emphasize that more, otherworldly.
Yeah. And we gave you a little taste last week of what we'd be doing this week, but what we did from the Great Sand Dunes, and I know this will be a shock to everyone and they don't know what's coming. But we drove a little bit south into the great state of New Mexico.
The land of enchantment, literally.
Did you find it enchanting?
Oh, certainly. I don't know. I mean, it was a fantastic little state. Little state.
It's a pretty big state. It's bigger than both of our states combined. But New Mexico was awesome. And particularly today, we're going to talk about one of our New Mexico stops. We have one more to get to in our next episode. But we're talking about Santa Fe.
Santa Fe. You see, I didn't sing it.
I heard you catch yourself.
And that could be anything. They can't catch us.
I think that's one we would be allowed to sing, actually, because if you just sing the word Santa Fe, that's not necessarily indicative of a particular song.
Nope, not at all. So take that, the cast of a musical.
Yeah, so without further ado, I'd love to hear you sing it.
Here we go. So it's been a minute since we've been recording. Jacob had to take all this out.
Oh, I didn't edit anything. You just chose not to do it.
Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful. It made him cry. But we're back.
That's right. I cried many tears, mostly of pain and misery, but a little bit of happiness and overwhelming by your beautiful, luscious voice.
Thank you. That's my whole point. If I make people cry, it's a job well done.
Yeah. Now, you might be noticing that I'm trying to liven this up a little bit, because what we're getting into today in Santa Fe, its history is dark, like really dark and full of violence and discrimination. So it should be an uplifting episode.
I'm so excited, fam. I mean, come on. Let's go. Let's get ourselves pumped up.
Okay. This is a longer one, but let me also note that my pronunciations as we go through this are going to be very rough, and I might break out more Antonio Banderas.
Well, if at least you're saying you might do that, because it'll liven things up. We got to give people a little bit of happiness.
Give them the real deal.
See, I can't come back with you on that one. I can only agree.
All right, let's get into it. The land Santa Fe rests on was originally occupied by the indigenous Tonoan people who lived in Pueblo villages along the Rio Grande sometime around the 11th century.
Samoan people?
No, Tonoan with a T.
Oh, well.
T isn't terrible.
T isn't Thomas. But yes. I mean, that's not too much of a surprise. We've been to plenty of places like that thus far.
Yes, and the Tonoans and other Pueblo people settled along the Santa Fe River for water and transportation. The Santa Fe River, by the way, had year-round flow until the 1700s, but by the 20th century, it was a seasonal waterway.
Ooh, that's cute. It's like a river in its free time. It's its little hobby.
Yeah, it's a hobby, but it's now recognized as the most endangered river in the United States.
Well, we saw it, Jacob. I'm pretty sure we'll get to that, but we did see it.
It's definitely endangered.
If you want to take a nice little swig of drink or water from that, you know, you're going to be hard pressed to find.
Yes,
that cup of water for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So moving on, we're going to get to the 1500s now. The modern-day New Mexico territory was claimed by the Spaniards in 1598 by Juan de Onate, but he was banished by 1607 for his cruelty to the native population.
Oh, Lord. I mean, can you imagine back then being banished for your cruelty to other people that weren't like you? I mean, what type of fucked up shit do you think this guy did?
I mean, we're talking about the era of like the guillotine, or maybe before the guillotine, before so like much that. More so, violent, so torture
much more
racks
arcane. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's when Don Pedro de Peralta stepped in, who founded a new city at the foot of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, which he named something longer than my list of childhood traumas, Jeremy. He named it La Villa Real de la Santa Fe de San Francisco de Asís.
That's a lot of days. It's a lot of days and nights.
But I could do it more Antonio Banderas if you want. I could really spice it up for you.
Hit me with it.
La Villa Real de la Santa Fe de San Francisco de Asís.
Whew. You got me all bothered there.
Ooh, got y'all hot and bothered. This established Santa Fe as the capital of the territory, making it the oldest capital city in the present United States.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, I got the vibe that it was an old place, so makes sense. It
turns out it's the oldest capital city.
That's pretty cool. And there is such a place as Frankfort, Kentucky, you know.
Oh, man. I can't even let you finish that. I'm going to move on. In 1680, lack of Native American representation led to the Pueblo Revolt, and the Pueblo people actually drove the Spaniards out of New Mexico to El Paso. Work, bitch.
Work, bitch.
I mean, work.
Yes, and now we have what we have from El Paso. Now we have Beto O'Rourke. It makes sense.
This is how progressivism starts.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
In 1692, he's back again. Our old friend Don Diego de Vargas.
Ooh, so this is going to pick up after he just kind of walked by the sand dunes and was like, oh, those are there. Let's keep heading south. So this is where his story continues?
Yes, Don Diego de Vargas reconquered the territory for the Spaniards in an effort that was criticized as violent, even for the time.
These are two people. So far we have two people that are just extremely extreme. Like, they're like, whoa, man, that's rough. That's too harsh. And it's the 1600s.
Like, you're literally making fires by rubbing two fucking sticks together, and you're going to tell me that they literally have people that are too violent?
Ugh, that is, there's no Geneva Convention, there's nothing during this time, and people, there's a limit. It's interesting to know that there was a limit back then, too.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But Santa Fe remained the Spanish capital in the region until the Mexican War of Independence in 1810, and then it took until 1824 when Santa Fe became the capital of the Mexican territories in the 1824 Constitution.
Wow. So there's Spanish influence in the area is what you're telling me.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm telling you.
Okay, I never knew that.
But now it's time to enter the United States into the chat, Jeremy.
Yes, sir. I always feel good when you talk about this part.
The United States doing what it does best, stealing land from natives through violence.
It's the feel-good story of the ages. It permeates time.
It's what you want to hear.
It's a transcending story.
It's your John Wayne fantasy.
Exactly.
And so that was 1836 that the Republic of Texas seceded from Mexico to join the United States and attempted to claim Santa Fe as part of the western portion of Texas along the Rio Grande.
Wow. So wait, they were trying to, so Texas, as huge as it was trying to take even more land.
That's exactly what was happening.
Okay, well, that's a little bit too much land there. I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, also, I think Texas had a much more northern border at the time. But
right.
Yes,
oh, yes,
they still had a ridiculous amount of land.
Right, right. Because no one was there. They're like, you know, we have it. And everyone's like, okay.
Exactly.
No one's there. No one's home. So go ahead.
Exactly. But Texas proved to be poorly prepared, and the expedition they sent to control the area was easily captured by the new Mexican military. Really, absolutely no Alamo realness going on here. They just completely flopped it.
Here's the thing that people forget about with Texas, with its size, with its thing with that it wanted to secede from Mexico. Yo, they had like no state capacity. They couldn't do anything. So that makes complete sense.
Oh, they had nothing.
They literally had nothing. And now they're like, we're Texans. Yiddle doy. exactly what they say. And that's their catchphrase. And they don't Yeedledor. They have nothing.
Oh wait, can I promote them this way? I'm gonna do it.
Yes.
Texas. Yeedledoy, get you some.
Yeedledoy. The stars at night are Yeedledoy.
I love
the heart
that.
Of Texas.
I love that. But 1846, this is the part now we're getting to that you might have learned about in your U.S. history class. The United States declared war on Mexico, beginning the Mexican-American War. And you had General Stephen W. Kearny lead the United States into Santa Fe to claim it in 1847. And in 1848, the U.S. officially gained New Mexican territory through the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, finally living out their manifest destiny fantasy.
Nope, never heard of it.
That's honestly what when people ask me about my favorite treaties, I just automatically go to Guadalupe Hidalgo because it kind of sounds funny.
Yeah, I don't know where they got that name from. That's actually something I don't know about. I mean, of course, I've learned about all this in history class, but they just got those cool names.
Well, it's actually from Guadalupe and from Hidalgo.
Oh.
Those are the roots of the words.
Okay.
But Americans first saw little promise in Santa Fe. And one 1849 traveler wrote, and I'm going to do this in the first voice that comes to my mind when I actually read this quote. I can hardly imagine how Santa Fe is supported. The country around it is barren. They are the poorest looking people I ever saw. They subsist principally on mutton, onions, and red pepper.
It is a shithole state, a shithole territory.
I mean, first of all, that's some bullshit. But it is exactly what I would imagine Trump saying if he ever bothered to visit a place of such cultural and historical importance.
Right. No, exactly. Here's the other thing, though. This person clearly didn't see that there was, you know, good functioning highways there when we visited, and he didn't see that there was a lot of people. And where the hell were the muttons and the onions? I don't know.
I did see the peppers.
We saw the peppers. I mean, that's cool. They hang from ceilings. But where were the hell were the muttons and the onions? I mean,
I couldn't tell you.
Nope.
No, we didn't see no sheep.
A terrible observation on this guy's part. Anyway,
absolutely,
probably what Trump would say. Indeed,
absolutely. So that brings us to 1851 when Jean-Baptiste Lamy arrived and built the Santa Fe Saint Francis Cathedral, which stands today. And we definitely saw it.
We definitely did. I mean, it probably was some beautiful looking structure because that whole city is beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful place.
I think I do have a picture of it, actually.
Yeah.
That we can put up with our photo dump on all of our social media at Road Boys Podcast for the episode.
Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Exactly.
Yes. So during the Civil War, a Confederate flag was flown over Santa Fe for literally 3 days before Union troops destroyed Confederate trains and forced them to withdraw.
Ooh, are you telling me the Confederacy lost a battle?
No, they win in everything.
Oh, okay, cool. Never mind.
That's why we have two countries in this landmass.
That's why we basically have two countries. They never lost.
You know, once I said it, I realized kind of how true it was, and that was kind of scary.
They never really lost. Anyway,
I'll keep going.
But in war, they didn't do too good of a job. They didn't stand up too well. So, excuse me. So. Well, you know, it's just all this more the same.
Yes, exactly. So we jump now to the 1880s when railroads were expanding westwards. The population of Santa Fe took a hit when the rail lines, including the Denver Railroad we talked about a couple episodes ago, decided it was more practical to go through the town of Lamy than Santa Fe.
Oh, that isn't good for the lifeblood of that type of a town like that.
I know, especially because they're already in the desert. Like, girl, what you gonna do now?
You gotta walk. You better walk.
Yeah, bitch, you better walk. But yeah, because it was bypassed, Santa Fe suffered economic decline into the 20th century, and this decline actually prompted activists to create a number of resources for the arts and archaeology, which is where we see the roots of where Santa Fe is today.
Oh, that's cool. when you're like, this place has nothing, let's give it some arts. Really cool. Makes for a cool town. Imagine if they did that for like Baltimore or Trenton.
Well, I picture it like they turn around and they're like, oh, this place has nothing? This place has nothing? Really, bitch? Really, bitch? Well, guess what? This place has everything.
This place has everything.
Yes, the very homophobic Stefan. Ooh, I said it.
Bill Hader's gay, right?
But believe it or not, New Mexico officially became the 47th state in 1912 with Santa Fe as its capital, which means, Jeremy, that there were people who are still alive today that were alive when Santa Fe, New Mexico, was not a state.
I mean, I think there would be. They would be very old, though, Jacob.
108, to be exact.
But who knows? I bet there's a lot of people out there. We passed by people living in, like, random places in the desert out there that I bet live to be very old because of the diet, maybe.
Yeah, because of the diet.
Because of the diet.
Yes, the diet of just eating chili peppers. This is also when the City Beautiful movement began, which we talked about originating in Kansas City. Remember that? Episode 3, Jeremy.
Nope. Oh. I wasn't listening.
Okay, great. Well, the city sponsored architectural restoration projects and erected new buildings according to traditional techniques, creating the Santa Fe style.
Ooh, so that is, I think that's called Pueblo. But that is cool that they actually had to enact something. I know that if you visit Miami, they actually had to make a charter to make all the stuff in South Beach be Art Deco. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I did look it up. It is called Santa Fe style. That's the name of the style.
I don't believe that.
All right. Well, all that lightheartedness takes us to another dark period in Santa Fe's history. It takes us to World War II realness.
Again, nothing could have bad could have happened there. It's just the desert. Nothing happens in Santa Fe.
Well, here's the thing. You always hear about the internment camps, and it turns out it was in Santa Fe. Beginning in 1942, the Department of Justice arrested 826 Japanese-American men after the Pearl Harbor attacks and held them in an internment camp located in Santa Fe.
Oh, that's awful. I didn't know that took place in Santa Fe.
Yeah, that's where the big facility was, Santa Fe.
A little bit random. I don't know. Did you find out why they would have put it there? Is it just because of the desert?
My understanding was, like, at that time, like, there was basically nobody there. And it was, like, kind of a place you could just keep people without too many people finding out about it.
Yeah, I mean, now you couldn't do that. But yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, security at the Santa Fe facility was similar to a military prison, with 12-foot barbed wire fences, guard towers equipped with searchlights, and guards carrying rifles, sidearms, and tear gas.
So what you're telling me is that it was a military prison.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm telling you, basically. It was a military prison.
Mm-hmm.
Santa Fe site was also used to hold German and Italian nationals considered enemies during the war, and it's important to note that at its height, the camp had 2,100 Japanese-American men who had renounced the Japanese Empire and were born in America.
See, this is a part of our history that is maybe one of, like, the darkest, I mean, along with slavery, racism. I mean, that's part of the racism there, but... It's also glossed over, I feel like. So that's the fact that I didn't even know about any of this happening in Santa Fe is probably just more testament to that fact.
Exactly. There's so many things like that in American history, but we won't dwell on that. The last eight detainees were released mid-1946, and the impact and stain, of the camp's existence exists. Oh, God, this is a bad one to mess up on. But the impact and stain of the camp's existence lives on today.
And here's the thing about it. I think I had been to Santa Fe once before we both went. And both times that I've been there now, I had never heard about this. So it's something that I still think impacts them. I don't think people like talking about this.
I mean, it's crazy. It's tragic that it happened. It's horrible that it happened. And it's a very dark period in American history.
That's correct. And we are not unfamiliar with dark periods of American history anyway.
And we're going to continue to wrap up Santa Fe's extensive history. It is now considered one of the world's great art cities, including Santa Fe Plaza, the Palace of the Governors, the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, and the Chuck Jones Gallery.
We should have gone to the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
Too bad it wasn't closed. Open. Yeah,
it was closed. I kept looking at it. I kept looking back at the website, and it wasn't open. They're too scared about the paintings and the coronavirus.
Yeah, you don't want those paintings getting the virus.
Nope, not at all. If it was something that could inspire Jesse in Breaking Bad, then I don't think it did actually. But still,
well, you know, I love that you mentioned Breaking Bad. Because that is going to be a huge focus in a future episode that I know might be premiering next week.
It may or may not be, but it may be, you know, we'll have to wait and see. Will it be featuring Breaking Bad? Who knows?
Who knows? But local, just back to Santa Fe real quick. Mm-hmm. Local Native American art and music are staples of the city, along with Pueblo Santa Fe style buildings and a rich food culture. And that is the history of Santa Fe.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to unpack there. A lot of darkness. But through it all, there's still a pretty, I'd say when we visited, you could still sense that there's a rich culture to Santa Fe, and it's a beautiful town.
I think you could definitely sense that there's a lot of charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
It's nerve to have those buildings. It's uniqueness to have those buildings, and it's talent to have those buildings.
What about charisma?
It's charisma to keep those buildings.
Oh, man, you really wrapped that up nicely. I love that. But that brings us right into what did we think of Santa Fe?
Well, I mentioned before that I had been there once, and that was literally the place we flew into on this trip that I had taken a long time ago. And I remember being completely just in awe of the place when I visited. The landscape is beautiful. There's mountains by it. And when we visited, I'd say the same about the landscape. But of course, we were coming from being in the sand dunes and being in the Rockies. So it's a little bit more of like hills. It seems a bit more like hills, even though these are basically mountains. And the town itself, it just struck me at how deserted it was in the middle of the summer. But that makes sense, right? That does make sense.
It does. Yeah, it definitely does. I thought it was really pretty. It was really out there. Definitely a huge change from even where we came from in Colorado. It was like very, you notice when we left the sand dunes, we drove through the border into New Mexico. We drove over the Rio Grande. And it was like entering a different world.
Yes, it's just one of those drastic landscape changes that happens gradually as you drive. And we from now on, as I always say, like from now on in our journey, we would encounter some of those types of drives. And I think this was maybe one of the first. Of course, we drove into mountains, but really to see go from mountains to desert, just two things that we're not used to, was pretty remarkable.
It was definitely our first like real desert experience.
Right. And by the time you reach that part of Southern Colorado, I think you have to drive a little bit more south than Alamosa. It certainly is like that. You can sense that it's becoming more and more deserty. It becomes a bit more shrubby. You don't see trees. But it's beautiful.
We drove through Carson National Forest, which was literally had no trees.
Right. So it was shrubs. So if we can look up the definition of a forest, what are they supposed to have? I guess they don't need to have trees. I guess that's what we found.
A shrubbery? What's a shrubbery?
A shrub forest. Was that Monty Python? I probably didn't catch
it. Was. Yeah, it was okay, Monty
good,
Python.
Good, good. Okay.
I'm glad you got it in retrospect, though. Yes. But my favorite thing we did in Santa Fe, this was so memorable, is we went right outside the city center. Do you remember this? We went right outside the city center because we wanted to go hiking. And
oh, yes.
And we found this mountain, and we just started climbing it.
Well, yeah, we needed to kill some time, I think, if I believe if I'm correct. And yes, we went and we did find a bunch of trails, a big trail system, which is in like this area right outside of the city center, as you mentioned. We started hiking those trails. At a certain point, I was like, I need, like, these trails need to go longer. Like, I think we should be in for a bigger hike. And yeah, I think we went off the path by a lot.
We certainly went off the path because we were not following a path up this mountain. We were just full scale climbing a mountain, like with no trail.
Right. It was very dry heat. We were sweating. Thank God we had we packed enough water, we packed enough Gatorade.
Lots of cacti.
And when we got up there, we had a beautiful view of everything, in this mountain range that is right by the city. You can clearly see the mountains if you're in the downtown center, but that's where we were. And then remember how treacherous it was getting down from there?
Oh my God. I really thought we were going to die.
Yeah. And then also, the comforting thing is that I think both of us kept, at least I kept my LTE the entire time. So I was able to just give us a reference when we were getting down from that mountain, to get us back on a trail. Cause I think there was a little bit of a moment in time where we were, I'd say we were lost.
Yeah, we were definitely lost. And also coming down, it was such a severe slope. The only thing that saved us were our hiking boots, our Timberland hiking boots, remember? Our
Timberland hiking
Timberland.
Boots.
Go on, get you some.
I really can't endorse those enough. Those were fantastic the entire trip. And they're comfortable, and I'm wearing them right now.
But I'm wearing them right now. That mountain was so cool, and we'll definitely, part of our photo dump will be a picture we took at the top of that mountain. So it's very cool.
Yes. And again, as always during this trip, seems to be the theme, beautiful weather. Beautiful weather all the way through. So yeah,
it didn't rain in the desert. The heat was hot.
The heat was hot.
Reference to another song right there.
Who knows?
And I just thought Santa Fe overall gave me a nice, comforting vibe. It felt like you were in a place of great culture. I loved seeing all the Native American art. In fact, you know, I wear a Native American ring, a Navajo ring. And
yes.
And I was actually approached by somebody on the street asking me where I got it. And I was like, actually, it's a family treasure.
Actually, I'm home. So there you go.
There you go. So that was Santa Fe. Anything you wanted to add to the impression before we move on?
Sure. Well, you mentioned, I don't know if you're too big of a fan of it, but they do have very good food there. If you're into spicy, into saucy.
You know, I feel like you'd think I'm not into spicy. I do like spicy. I just don't like it to be the primary thing that I'm tasting.
But that's the thing with that type of cuisine. It is they do make it the primary thing.
Yeah, I tried the green chili. It wasn't bad.
It's good. But that's the thing. If you're into it and you're okay with the pepper being a pretty big tasting part of the meal, we went and we got some of the southwestern cuisine down there, which always will have green and red chili. And it was delicious. I love that shit. And the soup, you have to try green chili soup. So good. Anyway,
there you go.
That's just a little bit of an endorsement for green chilies, so all the farmers out there can start giving me royalties and whatnot.
Absolutely. I love that. But I'm very excited now to transition into our dark history of the week because, Jeremy, I think I stumbled upon something big this week.
Did you now?
I did.
Is this about the UFOs in Roslyn, New Mexico?
No, it's
people
not.
People know about that, Jacob. People already know.
Well, yeah. I think I actually discovered something, and I think I'm the first person to compile a comprehensive list on the murders of a serial killer.
Well, that's big. You should submit this to the FBI.
I think I should. I had to do a lot of digging to piece this together. The history is complex, and there's not many resources available on what happened, because it happened in a relatively small city in the 1980s and 90s before there was any national database of serial killers and violent crimes.
It's just such a weird thought that there wasn't one at a time. It's like, you think that they would have thought of that in the 80s and the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, Mindhunter will show you that, but
Yeah, exactly.
R.I.P. R.I.P. to that show.
R.I.P. We said it at the same time.
Wait a minute. Before we go any further, I realize we haven't gotten to this yet, and I just need to completely sidebar us for 1 second. We watched Fargo yesterday. I'm telling you, this show is also a like secondary Fargo critique, but
it is.
That was the best episode they had by far of the season, and it still was bad.
Yeah. Maybe by the time that we get to the last episode of the season, you'll be like, okay, I guess that was a standard episode of Fargo that we know and love. Like it's building up to that one episode of the season.
It was so wrong. You know, they really did that show so dirty. And you know what I hate the most now is that they turned it into a horror series when it was never supposed to be about anything like that.
Well, it's a slight horror, like with what they've tried to implement in this season, with a certain component of the what's it called, the plot, if that's what you would refer to, plot.
Yeah, the paranormal parts that are always in that show have always been quirky. Now they're not. But anyway, we cannot waste any more time on this because this dark history. I read articles, court case briefings, interviews. I read it all to present you the serial killer murders of Kimberly Kendall, Janet Benoit, and Terry Mulvaney.
That's unfortunate that there are already three people that you've mentioned.
I know.
No, it's not. We're off to a great start, and I'm being sarcastic.
All right, dark history. Here we go.
Yes, here we go.
So I want to set the scene a little bit before we go into case details. In the 1980s, Santa Fe was a relatively small place with only 30,000 or so residents. Neighborhoods were friendly and open, and it was like a peaceful center of culture and art by that point.
So basically what we saw, but with less people.
Yes, exactly. However, this all changed in 1981 when women began to go missing. Between 1981 and 1989, 12 women vanished and were either murdered or never found, 10 of which are unsolved cases to this day.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
It's not good.
But the two murders leading to a killer were only solved in 2003. So you're thinking about this was happening in the 80s. During that time, it must have been really scary to live in Santa Fe because, they didn't catch the killer in that decade.
Well, it's scary in that you already gave me the population is 30,000 people, and I live where I am. It's a population of 25,000. So imagine if these killings were happening in an area that only had that amount of people. That's like a pretty bad rate of death.
Yes, it is. Disappearance,
really. Exactly, for a place that small.
So the two solved cases were the murders of Janet Benoit and Terry Mulvaney. We're going to start with Janet Benoit, who was a 22-year-old Arvada, Colorado resident moving to Arizona when she was killed.
Mm.
She had just landed a job managing a shoe store in Phoenix, Arizona, and was staying in Santa Fe for a night when things changed.
Oh, geez, what changed?
Well, this is the detail that gave me the chills on a personal level, Jeremy. Because we actually have a direct connection to what happened here. She had checked into the Comfort Inn on Cirillus Road for one night on her way to her job in Arizona. The name of that motel, Jeremy, was changed later. I'm not going to say the name that it is now to protect it, but we actually stayed at the motel where she was murdered in November of 1983.
Holy hell. Yeah, I guess we shouldn't say that name, but... Oh, God.
I know.
We could have been in that room, Jacob.
We literally could have been. And I think I mentioned something like that because we were on the first floor of it. And I was like, oh, my God, like this is such a murder vibe being on the first floor of a motel like this, you know, just right open to the parking lot.
Exactly.
But yes, it was the motel we stayed in. We had just come from a long stretch of camping and we wanted just to break it up with a night.
We did.
A motel.
And it was a nice room. If we could endorse this place, I would say it was fantastic and we had a great time there. And I guess there was a murder there too.
There was. And unfortunately, the details of the murder are brutal. The maids found Janet Benoit's body on a bed the next day and she had been raped and stabbed in the back and neck more than 30 times.
Lord.
Janet's brother David fought hard for her killer, to be caught. And by persisting with law enforcement, they soon discovered that more than a third of the motel's guest keys were just copies of the master key.
Okay, well that's a big oversight right there. And imagine, I guess it doesn't work like that now, but I guess back then it could have been just a regular thing. Like, of course it's just a copy of the master key, of course.
Yeah, but geez, David Benoit, now her brother, was able to sue the motel successfully, but unfortunately Janet's killer was not caught until 2003. I will get to that, but I want to set up some other details before we get there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So now we're ahead. Now we're in June of 1984. 25-year-old Terry Mulvaney was raped and strangled to death in her Santa Fe apartment. Terry was described as a kind woman with lots of ambition, which is, of course, heartbreaking.
That is sad. She had a lot to offer. She was a great person with a lot to offer.
Yes, she was. So when Terry was murdered, police began to suspect her neighbor, a previously convicted felon named David Bruce Morton, who is really the evil man at the center of everything we're going to be talking about today.
That's a sinister name already.
I know.
Morton.
I know. David Bruce Morton.
Exactly.
Shockingly, there's not too much to find on the internet about David Bruce Morton, other than that he was 24 years old in 1984 when Terry Mulvaney was killed, which means he was probably either 23 or 24 when Janet Benoit was murdered.
I see. Okay. So he's killing very young girls, very young women, rather.
Well, yes, but he's also 24.
Okay, so he's at least... No, that's not even a good thing. I mean, well, I was gonna say at least he's killing around his age range. It's like if he was 10, it's okay that he's at least killing 10-year-olds.
Thank God he's 10.
He's 10 and killing 10-year-olds.
Morton was suspected at first because he was already a felon and Terry's neighbor, but that wasn't enough to like bring him in or anything. But in 1985, he was arrested on a drunk driving charge, and a cellmate said he confessed to him that he killed Terry Mulvaney.
Oh, so it's like they got him on tax fraud. So they took down Al Capone, the DUI.
Yep, that's exactly how they did it. But unfortunately, it's exactly not how they did it, because local prosecutors said there wasn't enough evidence to charge Morton. Mulvaney's parents fought hard. It garnered a petition, even, that got a bunch of signatures, and it forced authorities' hands into a grand jury investigation of David Bruce Morton.
Ugh, okay.
He was put on trial in 1988, but the jury could not come to a decision due to lack of evidence, as authorities had said, and Morton was freed because of a hung jury.
Oh, he's an innocent man, of course. He's free to go.
Well, according to the court of law, he is an innocent man at that point.
I love our justice system.
Yeah, I know. So we have the details of the murders of Janet Benoit and Terry Mulvaney down. And after Morton was freed, he moved to Amarillo, Texas.
Amarillo, Texas.
Yeah.
Do you want to complete it?
Oh, I thought you were going to do it, but I can do it. All right,
here we go. You can do it better than me.
Go on. Get you some.
I think that could, if there's a town where that, where that catchphrase could have originated, it is Amarillo. I'm just saying.
Amarillo, Texas.
The birthplace. Okay, the birthplace.
The birthplace.
So anyway, this insane serial killer, awful human being moved there.
Yeah, anyway, this horrible, horrible man moved to Amarillo, Texas. This is where the story gets a little hazy because there's literally like no details I could find on his next victim. I did so many searches. I tried every variation of her name. I looked at different things. I even looked at her obituary. Her name was Kimberly Kendall. I wish I could give you more details because she deserves more than a quick blurb, but this was the only information available on the internet. All I know about Kim Kendall was that she lived in Amarillo, Texas with her husband, Steve. Steve Kendall was an account executive at an advertising agency and came home one day in 1990 to find his wife, Kim, sexually assaulted, strangled, and stabbed to death in their bedroom.
Well, he had the life that I wanted for a second there with that advertising executive position with his wife, and then it kind of went downhill.
It just seemed to go downhill.
It seemed to go very downhill, Jacob.
And then one thing we do know about this, of course, is that David Bruce Morton was caught and convicted of her murder, and his life sentence began in Texas in 1991.
So at least a little bit of justice is served. So now he's in prison.
Exactly. So he is in prison at this point. But let's jump back to Janet Benoit, the first known murder that we're talking about here. So her brother, we talked about before, David, he hired a private detective in 1995 named George Siebel to try and solve the case.
Now, oh yes, now when a PI is always hired, that's when shit really happens, I feel like, in a lot of these stories.
I agree completely. Mm-hmm. And Siebel pointed Santa Fe police to Morton in 1996 due to the similarities in the way the two victims were killed. But the Santa Fe police were reluctant to look into Morton again because of the embarrassment they suffered from the hung jury in Terry Mulvaney's case.
Oh, well, it's always just like the classic trope. We shouldn't look into it when it's like it's completely the truth.
It's just like the one thing they should look into.
It always is like that. It's just it's unbelievable. They don't want to do their job anyway.
Yeah. It took until 2003, 20 years after Janet Benoit and Terry Mulvaney were killed, to get a definitive answer. And that's when David Bruce Morton, who was 44 years old in 2003, pleaded guilty to murdering Janet Benoit and Terry Mulvaney while serving his life sentence in Texas for the murder of Kimberly Kendall.
Well, I guess, like, psychologically, it's just like, why not at this point? Why not admit it? He's already in prison for the rest of his life.
Right. He got to that point. And then, of course, I want to give, like, a positive spin to some of this in the best way I can.
Yes, Jacob, spin it positive. Spin it positive.
Actually, I want to read one more that's not positive first. Morton was sentenced to two more life sentences and transferred to a New Mexico prison, which is where I believe he currently is today.
That's crazy. He's still alive, so that's negative. But what's the positive?
Well, David Benoit, Janet Benoit's brother, said in 2004, "We feel better. He is in jail for this. I'm certainly as satisfied as I possibly can be." I mean, very sad, but at least there's an ounce of like closure in these tragic killings.
Yes. Some of the worst, I think the worst thing that could happen is if they just suspected this guy was the killer and nothing ever happened of it. This guy could live his life. And that happens sometimes. So.
It does. It does. But unfortunately, that's not quite the end of the story. There's a bit more to discuss because you remember at the beginning of this dark history, I mentioned that many women went missing in Santa Fe during the 1980s and most of those cases were unsolved.
Yes, you did say so. Pretty bad ratio there for a town that small.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're going to go back to those. Two of the other murdered women's cases were connected. That's something they have determined, even though they weren't solved. One being 25-year-old Susan Laporte, who was raped and murdered in Santa Fe while visiting a friend in December of 1985.
Awful. Again, awful.
Yeah, and her murder, as I said, went unsolved. But in 2009, an FBI agent was able to match a semen sample from her murder to another murder from the 1980s. Maria Padilla, a 29-year-old woman who was found assaulted and murdered in the same area in May of 1985.
Well, now we can get those samples. So that's pretty indicative. So this guy was just on a spree.
Well, yeah, I mean, those were unsolved cases, but now I'm going to bring in what an expert thinks of the situation. Okay. The reason I mention these horrible crimes is because of Tony Trujillo, a Santa Fe detective who had been working on all of the cases for their duration. And Trujillo suspects that David Bruce Morton was a serial killer and has gone on the record saying, I suspect him in about four other cases, including the cases of Susan Laporte and Marie Padilla.
So this guy is just out there killing people. And I wonder, with as little as there is known about this guy Morton, like what was going on in his head. It's always interesting to think about motivations, but like what could have been his motive and what was his life like? And is there anything, there's not much known about that, right?
Right. That's the stuff I couldn't find anywhere. I mean, I searched everybody involved's name. I read every article I could find on all of them. I read case briefings for some of the cases, and I still couldn't find anything detailing more about David Bruce Morton.
Wow. You dug deep, fam.
I really did.
You did your work. You put in the work.
I mean, like, what are we doing here? This is just the way to go.
This is the way to go in research. But that is interesting. And maybe, who knows, this could be an evolving thing, as it always is. We might know more. And we should get back to it. If you find out, we should give an update.
Yeah, maybe the case will get famous after this and it'll lead to some developments. We'll have to see. Yes. But, you know, of course, those murders of Susan Laporte and Marie Padilla led me to wonder how many of those other missing murdered women in Santa Fe during the 1980s could have been attributed to Morton.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds very probable. I mean, how many serial killers are going to be operating in a town of 30,000 around that time?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I mean,
29,000.
I don't know, man. It just seems like one of those crazy, crazy scenarios where
yes,
things are really weird, and we might not know too much about what actually happened.
At least for a little bit. Who knows? Maybe we'll get security footage. Maybe we'll get evidence.
Yeah, maybe. But that is the crazy, tragic, and underpublicized story of serial killer David Bruce Morton and his known victims, Janet Benoit, Terry Mulvaney, and Kimberly Kendall.
His known victims, and of course, maybe more. That is now you put the dark history in that one, sir.
I did. I know. I knew that when I was doing the research, I was like, this episode is going to be so dark.
Well, Here's something to look forward to next week. If you're a Breaking Bad fan, I think you're going to like the episode.
Oh, yeah. I think we're just going to title our next episode a Breaking Bad Eleganza Extravaganza.
Extravaganza Spectacular.
Spectacular. Alexis, spectacular. It's our Breaking Bad Eleganza Extravaganza.
I know that we have a huge contingent of Breaking Bad fans in our fan base of road persons, and they all get it. But I mean, there's a lot. I mean, we're going to cover that next week. But also, I just want to, you know, just say that even if you haven't watched Breaking Bad, it's a lot to look forward to next week. We did so much.
It's going to be exciting.
Stop. Look forward to that. It's coming out next Sunday, and that will be post-election day. So, it's a different world. Yes. So again, this is the Get Out the Vote Spectacular Part 2. And I just want to reiterate, if you haven't voted yet, just get your fucking ballot. Excuse me for that language, but just get it in. Vote, please. Vote, please. Just get it in. Hand it in directly. And there's a redemption arc and all this. Please just do it. Goddamn.
Yeah. I don't know how we got to that, but that brings us to our fan question of the week.
Our fan question.
We have our fan question to do.
The question is, who's going to win the 2020 presidential election?
Is that the fan question this week?
Oh, well, it could be.
the fan question, you were supposed to comb the inboxes this week.
Oh, yeah, that thing. Yeah. We got so many submissions, it's hard to even keep track. One of them I did see was who's going to win. Another question we got would be, why do we even need leadership? That's a good one.
Who'd it come from?
It came from Squain. Squanuel Squain.
Thank you for writing in. Why do we need leadership? I'd say we don't.
We don't? You don't think we do? Why?
I don't think we're going to have any of that. What was it? God, what's the name? Why am I blanking? Lord of the Flies bullshit going on.
Well, do you think stuff would just naturally sort itself out? Is that what you're saying?
I think everything would be okay. I think, you know, there's enough people that it would just be fine.
I think there's too much people that things wouldn't be fine.
I don't know. We don't need
you
no
ever watch
leadership.
The Purge?
Yeah, I saw the Purge. I saw the Purge.
Well, I'm asking you that, and I've never seen The Purge, actually.
It has nothing to do with that, but The Purge, yes. That's some bullshit.
Well, I don't know. I think it's just human nature. I think Jacob and I had a pretty deep discussion about this recently. Like, human nature tends us, our minds are linked or eventually we'll get to the point where we need an explanation for the stuff that happens in our lives. Now, I'm not going to go into our full discussion on that matter.
For the record, we had like a 2-hour conversation about this.
And no, we weren't on drugs. It was just that it was late at night and we were just like, let's just talk about this. So
I thought it was a really impactful conversation that at the end of the day brought us all closer together.
It brought us all closer. The fact that you even know that we had it should bring you closer together with the people that you, your loved ones, okay? And I think that, just coming from that conversation, we talked a lot about how our minds are just warped in a sense, but naturally maybe, to look for explanations in the things that happen in our lives. And I think one of those things could be the fact that we have to look up to people to guide us. We have to look up to things, we have to look up to entities, and that is leadership. That is part of that is leadership. And in my mind, that's where the need for leadership comes from. We need to be able to, if we're not in a position of power or leadership, to look up to someone who has it. And then you could get into a discussion as to why are those systems there for people to be above other people. But I think for the time being, you should know that comes from, you know, those systems being in place in the first place. But that's something that people look up to. They look up to leaders.
Jeremy, I look up to you.
Well, that's because I'm a leader, and that's because out of the two of us.
Oh,
that's why I don't do anything. I just show up for the recordings.
That's true. You do.
I do promotional stuff. I do advertising.
You didn't even find the fan question.
I did find the fan question. I combed. It was me having to look through our Gmail account. Gmail. Come on.
Oh, yes. Our Gmail, by the way, it's going to be live this week, and it's going to be roadboyspodcast@gmail.com. So if
it's
you,
going to be, this is present tense, it is live.
Oh, that's right.
Combed
it is live.
The emails. It is live because I combed the emails and I found a very good question. I think that's a very thought-provoking question that I found.
Yeah, from Squain Squanuel or whatever.
Squain Squanuel, but of course these are all fan, you know, they put in a username. It's all anonymous. No one wants to actually admit that, you know, they love us.
Well, you know who does love us?
Who?
Aaron Rodgers
out in the middle of nowhere, California. So thank you to him.
And just a quick recap, we visited Santa Fe this week. It was crazy. It was insane. We loved it. We climbed a mountain. We saw that chicken shit river they have there.
Yeah, the one that's named Santa Fe. The one that's it's a river and it's hot and it's free time. It's a little hobby. It's being a little river.
Now, would you recommend visiting Santa Fe?
Oh, totally. And I think with the culture, the food, and the sights around there, it is certainly worth the visit. It is the land of enchantment, and they're not joking. They ain't joking, bitch. When they
I'm
say
not
it's
joking,
the land of
bitch.
Exactly. And I think it will do you better to visit when we don't have a global pandemic. I think you'll see the vibe will be a lot better. It will be just as lively as when I visited back in 2013. So wait a little bit, then go to Santa Fe.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this week. Next week, we'll have a an outcome for a president. I was going to say a new president, but I didn't want to get too political.
I think just factually, we won't have a new president then at that very moment in time in early October, November.
You're correct about that. So we'll probably be discussing that next week a little bit at least, but we will, this is definite, have some amazing Breaking Bad content for our Breaking Bad fans out there.
And just amazing content in general for you unenlightened souls who haven't watched the best show, one of the best shows of all time. Anyway.
Yeah, and Better Call Saul, add to that list, by the way.
Again, one of the best shows of all time. So there we go.
There you go. So thanks for listening this week, and we'll catch you on the flippity flip.
On the flip flop flop. Yes, sir.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Road Boys, starring Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro as themselves. Produced by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Directed by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. And created by Jacob Velotti and Jeremy Shapiro. Special thanks to Vlad Glashenko for recording the intro and outro music royalty-free, and Tina Perkins, that's me, for recording promotional content. To learn more, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Road Boys Podcast.